It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. And we've been asking this hour what we can do about gun violence. My next guest has ideas about hatred, online hatred. Game developer Zoe Quinn has faced it personally. In fact, you probably know her best for the harassment against her, the so-called Gamergate affair, where online trolls lashed out at her and other women who develop video games. Her new book is called Crash Override: How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. Zoe Quinn, welcome to KUOW.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For those listeners who don't know what happened to you, would you please tell that story one more time?
Sure. The simplest possible way that I can distill 3 years of like convoluted internet stuff is that I had a 5-month on-again, off-again, mostly off-again relationship that was pretty abusive. And when I finally got away from him, he sort of capitalized on the background menace that was existing both online and in the gaming community against anybody that was kind of seen as an outsider. Whatever that meant was sort of up for interpretation in these in a number of different groups that specifically tend to hate specific people from different marginalized groups. So, like the furthest you get from like a 1950s sitcom dad, like Norman Rockwell type person. And he kind of engineered this post to be both a call to arms and something to damage my career and my life as much as possible, and kind of like marketed it to go viral more or less. And it did, and it served as that sort of rallying cry, and thousands at least of online strangers started brigading me with threats of all kinds of nature, finding out where I lived and sending me pictures of my apartment, talking about putting dead animals in my mailbox, finding out where my family lived. Like, it just, it went on and on. And as soon as people like the actor Adam Baldwin and Breitbart decided to involve themselves, it turned into a new front on basically a very old culture war, where it's like people who believe that the internet or technology or these spaces belong to them, and see anybody who doesn't look like them as a threat, start attacking the others.
And Zoe, the game that you were known for, to call it a game is sort of strange, but would you just briefly describe Depression Quest, which you co-created?
Sure. Depression Quest is sort of an interactive fiction game, so I tried to make it as accessible as possible to people who don't normally think of themselves as someone who plays games. It was really kind of there to sort of use the power of games to go beyond like that old adage about show, don't tell, and do, don't tell. So it's like you're given an everyday scenario where, you know, your girlfriend invites you out to a party. What do you do? And at the bottom, there's your list of options of how you want to respond. And the first one that's like the obvious, healthy, normal one is always crossed out. And then
it's not an option for you to choose that because you're depressed.
Exactly. But you know it and you can see it. You just can't do it. And as you try to wrestle with your illness, more things get crossed out. And sometimes if you've been able to have better coping mechanisms and stuff like that, like you start coming out of it a little bit. But at the end, it's never really cured. And it's more there to be like sort of 101 entry level conversation for people who think that depression is just like a bad mood, or for people who are depressed and feel like nobody else really gets that.
And this game has been played millions of times, and things get jumbled, right, about this backlash, this reaction, the hate, the online hate. What is it really about? Will you, first of all, give us an idea how your critics reacted, and then what do you think was really behind that reaction?
To the game?
Yeah, to the game, as you say, there was an ex-boyfriend who made a post and all that stuff. But if you could distill, what do you think was going on when so many people were galvanized about that and provoking you and threatening you?
I was different and a convenient stand-in for any kind of symbolic thing that people were feeling anxious or messed up about. I was, I think, very easy to project onto as like an invader or an outsider. And, you know, I think a lot of people end up coming to games and coming to a lot of kind of niche communities because they don't have other places to go. That's one of the reasons I fell in love with gaming at a younger age, was it gave me this whole other world to be when I was having kind of a rocky home life growing up. And it's sad that communities end up eating their own because they feel so fiercely guarded about like this thing that matters so much to them. And if that feels remotely threatened, then people start lashing out. And the key thing to realize, and probably almost any mob, is people always think that they're the good guys.
Yeah. I had the impression that the haters seemed to think that the gaming industry, which had been very male, was being taken over by political correctness and identity politics. Does that about sum up the claim?
Yeah, I'd say that's a major part of it, which is really weird because it's like they were going after the people with the least power in the industry at all.
Yeah. Did it occur to you that some of your critics seemed depressed?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There was a person who was, he wrote this beautiful piece called Here Lies My Hatred anonymously, where he talked about, like, how he had been a very staunch GamerGator, and, like, he got so obsessed with this, he ended up driving away his fiance. And at the end of all of this, he's like, what am I doing? And it turned out that he had undiagnosed depression. And, you know, it's not like, not to make any comparisons, like a lot of people with depression never do things like this to other people. But that said, like, I think a lot of people engage and lash out because something, they're missing something in their life. And it's an easy place to find community. And that's like a difficult thing to find for a lot of people. So, you know, I feel like for a lot of these people, it's not even really about the things that they're doing. It's just that they have people to be with that they feel like understand them and care about them. And, you know, everything else is just sort of a side effect, which ends up being really screwed up if you take any step back.
And Zoe, how much does that insight and that empathy you're able to find, how much does that play into the solutions to online hatred as you're talking about in this book?
Well, you kind of have to understand where other people are coming from just so you know, you can't fight against things blindly. And I think it's very easy to overreachingly demonize your opposition in a way that makes it so you're not really understanding the root of the problems. And then you're basically just putting Band-Aids on bullet holes at that point instead of really addressing the underlying issues. And it's like not my empathy isn't there to like excuse bad behavior or anything like that. It's just trying to understand like, OK, why does this happen and what can we do to work backwards from that?
Yeah. You know, what is something that, let's say, the tech industry is doing differently or could do differently to make the internet a less hateful place?
A big thing would be to actually enforce their own terms of service that they claim to really care about. You know, almost all of these platforms that were the place where these things were happening to me on, even like as recently as 2 days ago, like people were like sending me nude photos in public, like, and I got like a report. I filed a report.
Sending you your own. People had stolen personal information of yours, right? Including
yeah,
nude photos.
And my family's. And it got really intense, including hacking my accounts and all that.
Yeah. And the tech industry could stop that?
The tech industry says they want to stop it, but then they always make sort of half steps and excuses not to do it, which is really frustrating.
By the way, since we're in Seattle, do you make any distinction between Silicon Valley tech culture and Seattle tech culture?
I don't think that there is really a difference. Yeah. Tech is tech. You know, I think there's definitely a vein in tech that's like almost free speech absolutist to a degree that doesn't make sense and isn't consistent. For example, people will defend like stuff like death and rape threats, which are not actually protected under the First Amendment at these tech platforms. But we still remove spam, and spam is way closer to actually being free speech. It's just advertising. But since it impacts the quality of that platform, and we had all of these same discussions back in the early to mid-90s about, you know, can you remove spam? It's free speech. People have a right to do that. And ultimately, it came down to an issue of quality and saying, you know what, we aren't actually the government. This is sort of our platform. This is impeding the designed and intended use of the platform and making it a poor experience for everyone else, so we can make a pretty easy call here to get rid of it. And it's confusing to see that, you know, we leaving aside IP law and all that stuff, which can get overzealous and ridiculous, even just looking at spam and the fact that that's spam removal is a $1 billion industry now. It's like it's like the picking and choosing is very confusing. And beyond that, like, there's people in tech who engage in this sort of behavior as well. I mean, my ex who started all of this was a programmer.
Okay, then we've been talking about some things the tech industry won't do. So what are you advocating that, if not the tech industry, the government maybe, what are you advocating that we do differently?
I think the biggest thing right now, at least for actual progress on the front of just where these places, where all this abuse takes place, I think a big part is getting the general public educated about how bad the situation is and to not just accept like half measure PR grabs that don't actually materialize into something, and to try to cut into the bottom line, because the whole reason that these platforms don't do stuff, or at least a major reason, is because the internet runs on this economy of attention where, you know, having more eyes on something automatically translates to it being good, and that looks attractive to advertisers and shareholders and stuff like that. And until we, you know, are able to really challenge that and, like, make it so that it's not just incentivized to keep bad actors on there because it's making numbers go up, that's going to be tricky. What I would love to see is people who, you know, I'm still a game developer, I'd like to see people above my pay grade handle this, but look into areas of consumer protection and safety. And, you know, it's like, if you have a terms of service and you're not actually enforcing it or living up to it, is there any sort of, can there be any sort of issue there without, like, touching anything like the Communications Decency Act, which is this one piece of legislation that essentially allows the internet as we know it to function. Because, you know, removing that could have really, like, the collateral damage and messing with this stuff feels like trying to do open heart surgery on yourself.
So Zoe Quinn, best known for Gamergate, I'm sorry to say, but the author of Crash Override. We've been talking about account hacking and doxing, which is where people find and publish your private information to screw up your life. What about hatred, which is also in the name of your book? Did you learn anything from talking directly to the trolls who, you know, called you at home? Because you talked to some of them, right?
Oh, yeah. As soon as my phone number got leaked, I used to answer it. And the people who didn't just, like, scream a bunch of threats or slurs or whatever unintelligibly would be like, "Is this Zoe Quinn?" And I'm like, yeah, you called me. And they'd be like, "Oh, you know your phone number's on the internet, right?" I'm like, "Uh-huh, I'm pretty well aware." And they'd be like, "Oh." And then, like, this happened. I can't tell you how many times this happened. The next thing that people would be say would be like, "Oh, I'm sorry." Because it's like, I don't know, maybe it's just my generation who calls people anymore, right? But there's that, like, intimacy to hearing someone's voice like that, where it sort of took me from a dehumanized mess of pixels on a screen to, like, a person with a voice that they were talking to. And, you know, I can tell sometimes when I tell a really good joke on Twitter, because usually I'll get an apology from a gamergater who's like, "Oh, no, I laughed at something." And I just, and I hear it all the time. It's like, it sounds stupid, but I didn't realize you're a person. And it's like, yeah, I get why you wouldn't. It's like, you get caught up in this stuff so easy because it's not really about me at all. I'm just, you know, a witch to burn because your crops didn't grow in that well.
So we just have a minute left, Zoe. Then that insight, is there, that was so personal. You're taking phone calls one at a time. Is there, that most of us won't do that and don't want to. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you can pass on to us about who deal with online hatred in its more, I guess, mundane and ubiquitous form, the hatred on the internet?
Absolutely. I get pretty gloom and doom on both tech and any major institution, really, because stuff's super slow to change, and it's agonizing, and, you know, progress really takes time. But the thing about the internet is we don't have to wait. We can start, like, actively, you know, having better digital hygiene, really trying to look out for each other in our communities and be there and, like, know what to do if someone's being attacked, in terms of, like, okay, let's have some basic tech literacy here, secure your accounts, talk you through it. Just not giving bad advice like, "Oh, just go offline," when a lot of us live and work there and that's really just not feasible, as well as, like, just not engaging in accidental bad behavior that might have collateral damage ourselves. So really, like, that's like the biggest thing, is just getting informed about how this stuff actually works, making sure you're not part of the problem, and actively trying to take care of our communities as we go.
Zoe Quinn has written the book Crash Override, How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. And you're going to be talking about the book at Elliott Bay Books tonight, 7 o'clock?
Yes.
Zoe, thanks a lot for coming, I welcome you back to Seattle. We really appreciate you coming in and telling your story.
Thanks so much for having me.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.